Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Thousands of Colorado voters self-selected to unenroll before their information was sent to the Trump administration.
We catch up with a Roaring Fork native who has just completed a cross-country run, literally.
Preparations are made for the Glenwood Springs Bridge closure, which starts on Monday.
And we talk with a wildlife photographer for National Geographic.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
In response to one of President Trump's main fundraisers speaking at the Aspen Institute, nearly 100 locals came together yesterday to protest the administration's policies. Olivia Oxenhorn was there and has this report.
We are going to show the strength of our vision.
Former Texas Senator Wendy Davis incited cheers from the crowd at Pepke Park when she said Democrats must rally in the midterm elections next year. She was one of eight speakers who addressed concerns such as the environment, healthcare, and women's rights. Longtime local Linda Lafferty organized the march after she learned that one of Trump's closest supporters, Thomas Barrack, would be speaking today.
When I heard that Tom Barrack would be in our town speaking about Trump's vision for America, I thought, what about our vision? What about most of us, I think, but certainly in the Roaring Fork Valley, our vision has nothing to do with his.
The group marched through downtown Aspen, carrying signs with messages like, water is life. America was already great, and too pissed to pick a topic. Olivia Oxenhorn for Aspen Public Radio News.
Pitkin County voters will see a handful of ballot measures in the upcoming election. Allison Bechtesh reports.
This fall, ballots will include school board elections for the Aspen and Roaring Fork school districts, as well as finance questions from the Carbondale Fire District and the Starwood Metro District. Snowmass Village is asking voters to opt out of municipal broadband restrictions. Colorado Mountain College Aspen has candidate races and two issues to put to voters. Mail ballots will go out 3 weeks before Election Day. There will be ballot drop-offs in Basalt, Snowmass Village, and Aspen, as well as a week of in-person early voting at the Aspen Jewish Community Center. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
After 5 months and over 3,000 miles, Roaring Fork Valley native Ricky Gates completed his run across the United States. Elizabeth Stewart Severy caught up with him by phone just after he ended the trip in San Francisco.
Ricky Gates set out from Charleston, South Carolina on March 1st. He crossed 11 states, well, 12 if you count Mississippi.
I was technically in Mississippi waters along the Tennessee River, but I didn't set foot on land, and I would hardly say that I had any sort of cultural experiences in Mississippi.
And cultural experiences were the primary focus of the run. Gates is a professional runner and has raced all over the world, but he wanted to better understand his own country, and he did so during a divisive time.
I do believe that all of these things that we're discussing on the political stage and fighting for, I do believe that they're very important, but I've also seen them tearing relationships apart.
His journey was about meeting people with differing experiences, opinions, and backgrounds, and visiting places he hadn't seen. And in that, Gates says he was successful. But it was also a long personal journey, including crossing the deserts of Utah and Nevada in the heat of summer.
If this trip was primarily about meeting people, going through the desert was primarily about getting to know myself a bit better.
Gates finished the cross-country trek earlier this week with a final run across the Golden Gate Bridge. He's now working with Solomon and the film company The Wandering Fever to capture the experience. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
An effort to better track drugged driving arrests in Colorado is now in effect. As Benta Berkland reports, the measure requires law enforcement to document what substances are contributing to DUIs beyond alcohol.
Right now, not every jurisdiction records information on people driving under the influence of drugs, and most DUIs get lumped together. Democratic Representative Jonathan Singer of Longmont is the main sponsor of a bill to change that. If someone is mixing alcohol with other drugs, he says the state wouldn't know.
If they blow a .08, it is pretty rare that law enforcement will test for other substances. .08 is a per se limit. Most other drug tests are really expensive compared to a breathalyzer.
Law enforcement agencies must now look at past DUI convictions and test those samples for drugs. The goal is to report back to the legislature to better understand how marijuana, prescription drugs, and other drugs are contributing to DUIs. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
This summer, the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, made a ruling that will result in longer delays at the Aspen Airport. Reporter Allison Bechtesh checked in with Airport Director John Kinney, and she's here with me now. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
So what changed this summer over at Aspen Airport?
It has to do with our runway. Aspen Airport is very unique. Only one other airport in the whole country does takeoffs and landing the way that we do. The majority of airports work like a drive-through window. Whether you're coming in to make your order or driving away with your food or your coffee or whatever, everyone goes the same direction. But imagine if you got your food and then turned around and left the way you came. That's what happens in Aspen. Planes taking off go head-to-head with planes landing. Imagine at that drive-through line if the window attendant could look out and say, hey, no one's behind you, go ahead and leave early. That's kind of what's been happening with air traffic control giving a VFR or a verbal okay to kind of skirt that procedure and just let airplanes come and go if it's safe. As you might imagine, this made the FAA a little nervous. Here's Airport Director John Kinney.
So the internal components of the risk and legal said, you know what, you guys really need to go time out on that procedure, suspend it. And if you suspend that procedure, instead of having separations of 10 miles between aircraft, let's push it to 20.
So a little slap on the wrist and a new requirement that puts even a further separation between aircraft, which means less takeoffs and landings an hour, which means delays.
Is this a permanent change?
No, it's a study period. Representatives from the FAA, the Aspen Airport, the airlines that use the airport, all interested parties are on the phone every week with each other. 2 weeks from now, there'll be a roundup of this study period, and the FAA will make short-term, midterm, and long-term solutions.
So how does this fit in with the long-term improvements being looked at?
We've been reporting for years now about a potential reconfiguration of the runway. Right now, we're also out of compliance with how close our taxiway is to our runway. We're grandfathered in, but if we make any changes, we have to come up to code and separate those more. And changes will be needed to the ramp within the next couple of years, so that's why plans are already being made for updates to the runway, which will be bigger and longer, which means the potential for bigger planes coming in more frequently.
How soon will that happen?
This fall, the final environmental assessment standings come in, basically saying how the airport property would have to mitigate some surrounding impacts if it does change that current runway configuration. I don't see the FAA turning this down, just saying, hey, those wetlands between Buttermilk and the Aspen Airport are going to be affected a little bit. Here's how you mitigate that. That environmental assessment will be presented to county commissioners, and there will be public outreach at that time. So listeners who want to talk airport can plan on chatting with Director Kinney this October.
In the meantime, maybe get to the airport a little bit early if you're flying out. All right. Thanks, Allison.
My pleasure.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Stay in the know with what's happened in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram and like us on Facebook for news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
More than 5,000 Coloradans are no longer registered to vote. They self-selected to unenroll prior to their information being sent to the Trump administration on July 31st. Allison Bechtesh reports.
In late June, a Trump administration request for election records caused backlash across the country and resulted in multiple lawsuits. Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams announced that he would be turning over the publicly available data that he had. Since his announcement, 5,300 voters canceled their registration, meaning they can no longer vote in Colorado elections unless they re-register. Only 600 of those were registered Republicans. Throughout Pitkin, Eagle, and Garfield counties, nearly 100 voters withdrew their enrollment. Voters do not have to say why they are removing themselves from the rolls, so election officials can't say definitively that it was the investigation that motivated them. Pitkin County Clerk Janice Voss-Caudill says she hopes those who made that choice will re-enroll before this fall's election.
I'm saddened that people, it's like self-voter suppression.
Williams was one of the only Secretary of States in the country who was willing to turn over the election data when first asked by the commission. He now has a political challenger for his seat in 2018, Democrat Jenna Griswold.
They're really on a witch hunt for non-existent voter fraud, and there is a serious concern that we'll be facing attempts to roll back our voting rights. So yes, absolutely. This has definitely galvanized me in jumping into the race.
The Secretary of State is responsible for campaign finance regulations and business licenses. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Streets in downtown Glenwood Springs were repainted last night. This is to get everything ready for Monday morning when the Grand Avenue Bridge closes. Wyatt Orm has the details.
The new paint job will send traffic onto the Midland Avenue detour. This part of the detour is referred to as the squareabout. If you're headed out of Glenwood, you'll go one way around a city block, between 8th and 9th Streets, and vice versa if you're headed the other way. Even with the new paint job, drivers will still be able to cross the Grand Avenue Bridge until 12:01 on Monday morning. That's when the old bridge closes and traffic will be rerouted onto Midland Avenue. The new bridge is scheduled to open by Thanksgiving. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Last month, the Aspen City Council decided in a work session that it would be too risky to send a question to voters this fall about financing a new government building. It's estimated to cost almost $23 million and would be located at Rio Grande Place. As the deadline for ballot measures nears, reporter Allison Bechtesh looked into the conflicts in the council chambers and in the public that have led to this point, and she joins me now by phone. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
Tell us what happened in that work session.
So the city is building new offices. As with any big purchase, they're looking at loans, and basically they have two options for loans. One gets a lower interest but needs voter approval. The other is called a certificate of participation. It has a higher rate. We're talking about around $400,000 pricier when all is said and done, but it doesn't need voter approval. So if it was cost alone, the council would choose a lower interest rate. But there's some concern on council about sending the finance question to the voters who might not approve. Councilman Burt Myron thinks it should be sent out, especially if you think voters don't want it. Why would you push through something against public will? But it's not even clear that voters wouldn't pass it.
Yeah, that's right. 2 years ago, voters affirmed an advisory vote that asked if the city should convert the current city hall, also known as the Armory, on Galena Street to community use and then build municipal offices somewhere else.
I think when council backed out of that is where a problem started.
So what's their hesitation? Why not take it to a vote?
Some councilors think too many lies or misinformation will be spread if it goes to a vote. It's also just not common that the public wants to spend money on a public development. Here's Aspen City Manager Steve Barwick.
I would stress, don't underestimate the possibility of losing this. People generally do not vote for this type of thing. There's nothing in it for the average voter from their perception.
There's also that philosophical question. Ward Hauenstein pointed out at the beginning of the meeting, it's just bad practice to skirt the voters.
Where does Ward stand on this?
So he was very strong at the beginning of the meeting. He felt that this should go to a public vote. He also said it in a debate with Tory in his runoff election that he absolutely would send City Hall to a public vote. Then during that work session, City Council did allow public comment, which they've chosen not to do in the past. Some of those comments actually did have some misinformation in them, which got Ward worried that misinformation would spread. So by the end of the meeting, he said, I think we shouldn't ask the voters. He has since heard in letters to the editor and comments from his top donors. I think he's a little bit on the fence now. Adam Frisch also feels conflicted about skirting the voters. This issue is going to be talked about again in a work session either next week or the following week, where multiple options will go back on the table. Council will take another vote.
Okay, thanks, Allison.
You're welcome, Kristen.
National Geographic photographer Amy Vitale has traveled to more than 90 countries documenting war, wildlife, and the environment. She was in Aspen earlier this week to share her photos and stories. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy talked with Vitale about her work.
So, Amy, your talk is about keeping true to your belief in the importance of living the story. Can you tell me what that means to you?
I mean, that's a really brief way of saying that I believe it's really important to go deep into every story, which means I spend years on every single story I work on. And it means that I go and really live in every place I'm working instead of parachuting in. Because in the beginning, I was a wire correspondent working for Associated Press, and I would literally fly into a place, parachute in for a few days, and leave. And how can you possibly do justice to the people in their story when you've already got the story in your head before you even landed?
Mm-hmm. Now, you cover some of the most compelling and engaging wildlife stories that are happening in our world right now. What are some of those most compelling stories? What are you seeing?
Well, I think you have to come to the talk to hear them. No, they're actually really, they're stories that will surprise you because it's really easy to turn on the news and think that the world is over. And the truth is, We have enormous challenges that we have to overcome. But I also see these incredible things happening that give me hope. And I think it's very important to talk about those because they become the blueprint for other places. And I don't think that only talking about the challenges and the things that divide us will get anybody out of bed in the morning and want to do something about it. And so my goal is to try to motivate action and inspire people to get out there and make a difference in their own communities.
And we see that through your work. So your most recent story in National Geographic was about a community coming together to save elephants. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're seeing there?
Yes, that is where I'm headed in a few days. I'm headed back there because what I'm seeing, it's called Retete Elephant Sanctuary. It's the first community, indigenous community owned and run elephant sanctuary in all of Africa. The other thing is they're hiring, it's the first women elephant keepers in all of Africa. But it's the community taking ownership of the wildlife there and out there protecting them. It's such a beautiful, hopeful story. And against all odds, they're succeeding.
Now, one of the things that first brought your photography to my attention was your work with giant pandas. In addition to being some of the cutest photos I've ever seen, can you talk a little bit about your work with pandas and what you're seeing with populations coming back?
Sure. That was another surprise story. I think when we read news about China, we generally assume that we just hear the bad environmental stories. You can't possibly imagine anything good is happening there. So that story blew my mind. I really started researching it, spending years and time getting to know the people behind the animals and trying to save them. And it was such a hopeful story. And then at the end of it, after we published in National Geographic, about a month later, the panda was actually taken off the endangered species list. I'm not saying that they still don't have massive challenges, but there's a lot of things that people don't know about. China is doing a lot. It's one of the only countries in the world right now where forest coverage is actually growing. They're spending massive amounts to connect corridors where the pandas, the little pockets where they still live, and create more habitat for them. And frankly, the panda is then the ambassador for all these other endangered animals that are living in those same places.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy Vitale is a photojournalist for National Geographic.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Kristen Kay. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Carbondale's trustees appointed Luis Llanes to their board Tuesday night. He's 43, he's lived in Carbondale for 2 years, and in the Valley for 8. He's in charge of exhibitions for the Aspen Art Museum. The trustees interviewed 6 applicants in total. Integrating the town's Latino community was a central topic in the discussion. Llanes speaks both English and Spanish. He will serve until April of 2018. The position was vacated by Katrina Byers, who moved to Glenwood Springs.
The U.S. Forest Service will be closing Difficult Campground for the remainder of the 2017 season. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, the popular spot needs some repairs.
The drinking water system at Difficult Campground dates back to the 1980s, and Shelley Grail with the Forest Service says it's time for an update.
It's basically routine maintenance, so that we can upgrade the system and modernize it.
The campground will close Tuesday, August 15th, so crews can dig up pipes and complete major repairs. Grail says the water quality is tested regularly and is not a concern. The Forest Service has sites further up Independence Pass at Weller Lake and Lincoln Creek for campers looking for spots. Repairs are expected to take 2 months. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Glenwood Springs City Council postponed another decision on its contract and lease with the Glenwood Center for the Arts. That's after a 4-month investigation into the Arts Center's financials uncovered about $20,000 in unauthorized spending. Here to help explain the situation is arts reporter Claire Woodcock. She joins me in the studio now. Hi, Claire.
Hey, Kristen.
So, Claire, you've been following this story for months. What's the latest?
Well, last Thursday, the Glenwood Springs City Council met with the intention of deciding whether to cut ties with an arts nonprofit suspected of misappropriating funds. And the decision was postponed to another meeting on August 17th. This is after council held off on making any decisions the week before last. Before the city council met, the Arts Council held its own meeting where the membership and board voted to turn over Arts Center programming to the city.
So Glenwood Center for the Arts has been a part of the community for decades. How is the Arts Center doing and what are their plans to move forward?
The Arts Council is definitely in a tight spot. In June, Aspen Public Radio reported that the board and the supporters of the Arts Center raised roughly one-third of the debts owed to its teachers, who until that point hadn't been paid since February. That event was considered a success. But the Arts Council is still on the hook for $50,000 owed to both its teachers and vendors, and not much has been heard about fundraising since.
So how can the city expect to take over and preserve what people think is important for arts in Glenwood Springs?
Supporters of the Arts Center don't want to see it totally collapse. However, at the end of the day, both the city and the Friends of the Arts Center have the same goal in mind, to maintain arts programming in the community and to continue providing opportunities for kids invested in the performing and visual arts and to resurrect programming for kids in the fall. The city took over programming for the annual Glenwood Springs Summer of Music Outdoor Concert Series, and that model seemed to work out just fine.
So where do we go from here? How are both councils planning to move forward?
The city's decision was postponed last week because a formal agreement had not been written. So that document will need to be drafted and reviewed by the city. The police investigation, which began in April, has wrapped up and the case was turned over to the district attorney's office to get formalized. There's been some talk that the city would reinstate many of the teachers previously employed by the Glenwood Center for the Arts in the fall.
All right. Thanks, Claire.
You're welcome.
This summer, the Aspen Skiing Company is partnering with two CU Boulder graduate students to study housing in the Roaring Fork Valley. The team is looking at Airbnb, VRBO, and other short-term rental websites. The study will look at how they affect town character, transportation, and full-time housing stock. Allison Bechtesh spoke with Joe Stein, one of those researchers, about their initial results.
So the premise was locals think it's new homeowners who are buying homes in order to strictly make them right. A for-profit short-term rental. And that's not what you're finding?
Our initial findings are that in Aspen and Snowmass, these communities that had a large glut of tourist-centered housing because they were resort communities already before the rise of Airbnb, we haven't seen a loss there. For what we're seeing is that most of the sites that are posted were already lodges to begin with. And so we're not seeing that. But we have not yet come to that full conclusion down valley. We still need to dig into basalt and a couple other places and really see if these effects are being pushed down valley.
Are you looking at any other effects, how the tourism industry might affect other costs of living, quality of life for those who are here?
It's mostly housing availability, but with housing availability comes cost of living and all those other issues. For instance, we found in basalt that, at least according to a 2008 report, and these numbers may be a little bit old, job growth was around 93% from 2000 to 2008, whereas lodging increased only about 40-some percent. And so really, lodging is not keeping up with the amount of people that basalt and the valley in general are bringing into town.
So one aspect is this data mining, and you said your aspect is a little more social, talking
right.
to the community.
Right.
Who are you talking to, and what are you learning just from Valley residents?
Well, it's really interesting. I'm actually living in employee housing right now. So I've gotten to meet a lot of seasonal staff. Some of them are actually full-time workers, but they have to be in seasonal housing because there just isn't enough. It's pretty amazing just to experience that level. I live with 28 other people, and there is one kitchen. Having that experience has been awesome for me because I can now have that perspective writing up our final white paper. These are what people live with in order to be here in this place. I think everybody that I've talked to has several jobs or works one job constantly. That's just an incredible thing.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Joe Stein is a master's student at CU Boulder. He's in Aspen this summer studying the effects of the short-term rental market on our housing supply. We continue our conversation with Joe later in the program. I'm Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
Carbondale started taxing Airbnb. Would we see more policies like that, or how does that fit in with your research?
Yeah, I think that the key policy that a lot of towns need, whether or not they choose to regulate a little more strictly, is something to enforce their tax policy. A lot of towns have this requirement that Airbnbs and VRBOs have to collect and remit taxes and have to be registered, have to have a business license or a sales tax license. And there's really no enforcement scheme right now. So the requirement, and Aspen's thinking about this, Carbondale just did this, so it's definitely in the works. But what we need is an ordinance that requires that business license or sales tax license to be posted along with the Airbnb posting, so that town officials can go in and say, okay, all units in this town are supposed to have this license. Any of them that don't, we can shut them down or get them registered.
Among all the people you're checking in with, are any of them the people who own the homes that are being rented out?
Yeah, that's something that we're trying to hear from people. So, you know, this would be an opportunity where maybe your listeners could come in. We'd like to hear from people who are operating Airbnbs and hear the positive side of things, of course. One thing that we heard talking to Jay Harrington, the town manager of Carbondale, they had a lot of people come forward and say, actually, the fact that I'm allowed to operate this Airbnb allows me to afford to stay in this community, and really is sort of the opposite of what the perception is, right? So that's something that is really interesting, I think.
Are you looking to see if any of these are affordable housing units, you're not allowed to rent out?
That is another perception that a lot of people have here, is that employee housing is largely being used, you know, illegally to rent out, like people are renting out their couch or whatever. We haven't found that, but that being said, it's very difficult to determine that. The way that deed-restricted housing works here is that often there will be like 3 units within a larger complex of 40, and on Airbnb, the unit number won't be listed, and so you don't know which apartment that is. I think that a lot of people assume that hotels and Airbnb are sort of in conflict, but what we've found is that hotels are actually starting to use sites like Airbnb and VRBO to fill their unfilled rooms.
Then at the very end, where could this lead us?
There are a lot of registration options. I mean, there's so many ways to regulate and tax and keep these units in check. From the extreme banning secondary homes, as in Boulder and Denver, to not really doing much, like Vail is doing.
I mean, the objective of putting in any regulation, I would think, well, first of all, to capitalize on the tax that's owed, and then second, to provide housing. I mean, I would think those taxes would have to be really, really high for someone to ultimately pull their house off the short-term market.
Correct. There's a study that was done on the East Coast, and they looked at 14, I think, cities across the nation, and they found that less than 20% of people reported that their choice would be changed if they were required to pay a tax.
And probably regulation alone will not create housing in the valley. We also have to find other new development or other places.
Whether or not Airbnb and VRBO are contributing to this phenomenon, there's a lack of housing, lack of full-time housing throughout the valley. And so it's a serious problem. And, you know, of course, that drives up the costs of livability here in town. And it just limits the people that can be here, according to money, which is, you know, maybe not something you want.
Thank you so much for coming in today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Joe Stein is a master's student at CU Boulder. He's in Aspen this summer studying the effects of the short-term rental market on our housing supply. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen.
And I'm Kristen Kay. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. I talk with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.